Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is October 17th, 2016. Now, the big news for oil last year was its collapse in price, which destroyed a huge amount of necessary capital investment in the oil sector. Now, here's what I said during the intro to a podcast with Gail Tvergberg back in January of 2015. So that's a little more than a year and a half ago. Quote, "As I look at my trading screen right here on the 12th of January, 2015, I see WTIC crude oil falling another 4.8% on the day and trading at less than $46 a barrel. These prices are damaging to oil exploration companies' bottom lines today and tomorrow's hoped for production, and they are destabilizing to an increasing number of oil exporting nations," end quote. Well, listen, obviously the destabilization happened. Obviously, we have a lot more data now about the destruction of not just the oil exploration companies' bottom lines, but also their investments that were not made. Listen, energy is everything. The world has no legitimate plan B for liquid fuels at this point. Not one that I've seen at any rate. And no, electric cars, I'm sorry to say, are not coming online fast enough to make a real difference. Yet. But even when they do, we'll discover that there's a big, complicated, messy, dirty world behind the receptacle into which we plug our nifty green vehicles. And more frighteningly, the world's population is eating fossil fuels. Not directly, of course. Nobody's crunching down a piece of coal for breakfast at this minute, but just one tiny step removed. Every calorie of food in the West has 10 or even 20 calories of fossil fuels silently embedded within them. So thinking about all this is difficult, emotionally challenging even, and some it's really something that most people and most governments would rather avoid. But look, keeping our heads in the sand about all this, that's not an option either. Well, to discuss all this today, we are welcoming back to the show Gail Tvergberg to discuss this, and not a minute too soon. Now, you all know Gail, she's a professional actuary. She applies her risk assessment expertise to finite world issues, oil depletion, natural gas depletion, water shortages, and climate change. And for years, Gail has authored some of the most informed analysis on the global net energy predicament. In her post, first at the Oil Drum, where I ran across her, but more recently under her very popular blog, OurFiniteWorld.com. And there you'll find both really intelligent articles and super intelligent comments. She's got a great thing going there. So, Gail, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start. Look, so much is happening in the world. We could easily get into the details. But before we do, I want to back up, widen the view out first. If you were at an energy conference, say one focused on making a transition to alternative energy, what would be some of the biggest fallacies or false beliefs or misconceptions that you'd untangle if you could?
Well, it's hard to know where to start. But, there's part of the issue is that we need a transportation fuel. We need a liquid transportation fuel that operates in our existing vehicles. And, you know, the biofuels are just not cutting it. And, you know, there's no way that we can transfer to electric in a reasonable time frame. You know, this is one of the misconceptions that's out there. It's just, it's much too big a problem. And you've got your Caterpillar tractors and all of these things. It's not just your private passenger autos. And there's even the issue of how you keep making your roads and things like that. I mean, we use the asphalt for making the roads themselves, as well as for operating the machines that make the roads. So all of it gets tied very much together. So there's that issue. But there's another piece of it, too, is that intermittent energy isn't at all the same as the other our intermittent electricity especially is not at all the same as regular electricity. And in fact, you know, as I've talked to some people that are more involved with it from, you know, actually working with the transmission lines, it really, just trying to scale it up becomes just an unreasonable problem very quickly. And the whole idea that we can just push the problem off over to those transmission people and they can magically wave a magic wand and make it happen isn't going to happen. There's just too much of a physics problem. You can't get wind and solar to all kind of work together and somehow or other support the grid without spending many, many, many times the amount of energy that the wind and solar makes to fix your grid to make it work. So the whole thing just falls apart when you look at it that way. But at best, the wind and solar are just a tiny supplement to what we have right now. It might slightly reduce our oil and gas usage, but not very much.
Right. You know, the only credible plan I've seen, and by credible, I mean it was within an order of magnitude correct. It's not really a full plan, but it was a thought piece put out by the director of China's National Grid, which manages all of the electrical grid for China, proposing to the world that the world, if we really wanted to move to alternative energies, no one country could do it. So they proposed the world should do this, and we would populate the Arctic with wind towers because the wind's always blowing up there, and we would populate desert regions with solar, and we would then spend around $50 trillion globally doing this to both put that infrastructure in and then create the pipes necessary, the grid pipes, to bring that electricity to the markets. $50 trillion would be roughly 2/3 of the entire world's economic output. That's a massive number. It's several orders of magnitude larger than anything else I've seen proposed. I don't even know if it's like off by a factor of 2 or 3. I don't know. But it was the only thing I saw that was even remotely close to something I would say, yeah, we could start with that as an idea.
Right. And then, of course, this stuff would be subject to all kinds of hurricanes and all kinds of natural forces. So you'd constantly need to be repairing it all and replacing it over time. So, you know, there would be an ongoing cost to it as well. There's an energy loss problem when you start trying to ship your electricity thousands of miles, mm-hmm. you know, so you'd have to really overproduce in order to make it work that way. And then you start ending up with resource problems and trying to keep up this whole big grid. And you would end up with, you know, some large share, well, at least large relative to what we're currently using, share of the population working on keeping up this grid and trying to make everything work, because, you know, it would be so hard, you know, $50 trillion, we're talking wages of a lot of different people would be working on this stuff. So they would not be manufacturing other things that we need.
Oh, absolutely.
So it would not be good for us.
Well, absolutely. And I want to get to that economic component in a minute. The first thing I want to start here, though, is this. Look, I read all the headlines, and I have such compassion for the people who just want this all to turn out well. I get it. And you read the headlines, which are like, fossil fuels are dead, or, you know, the alternative energy future is right around the corner. And I get that. They're really based on belief. And this illustrates it really well. I was following Charlie Hall's work with Prieto, where they actually calculated the energy returned on energy invested for Spain's solar systems, right, which are some of the largest in the world, and they've got great data collection. So instead of calculating it with numbers sitting at a desk going, well, theoretically, you know, this all works, they said, well, what's the real world experience? And they came out with a very disappointing energy returned on energy invested of 2.45 for the solar system, which is not enough, as you're saying, you know, to deal with the long-term issues of both maintaining and then rebuilding this thing when it inevitably fails. And what I loved was, they, instead of calculating this stuff behind the desk, they went out into the world and they extended their analysis to include, and I'm quoting here, road access to the plants, foundations, canalizations, perimeter fences, evacuation lines, rights of way, Module washing, security and surveillance, transportation, sometimes as far away from China, premature phase out or unamortized manufacturing and other equipment, insurance, fairs, exhibitions, promotions or conferences, on and on and on. I'll stop there. That's literally a tiny fraction of all the other stuff they said is actually involved in installing and running something as simple, and I'm using this word carefully, as a solar installation.
Right. And I think that if they'd gone farther, they would have found that there were even more things. You know, if they were to scale this up, there would be this exponential increase in the cost of trying to keep the grid going, for example. And then there's also this issue of trying to finance the whole thing. Suppose we had an extra $50 trillion of this infrastructure. You know, do you think we have this saved up so that we don't have to finance it all? You know, somehow or other, we would, you know, where are we going to add an extra $50 trillion of debt to our current level of debt? It's just not going to happen.
Oh, indeed. And this is the part that I think is the critical part that's really missing out. So technically, it's all possible. But from a resource standpoint, maybe not. Maybe there's some questions. Is there enough neodymium to make all the strong force magnets that are needed in wind towers? Is there enough silver to create all these connections between the solar panels as they're manufactured? But it's the energy and economy component. You have a very recent piece out, came out on October 11th, why energy prices are ultimately headed lower, what the IMF missed. I want to get to why prices are headed lower. But first, the very first chart, this is why I love your work so much. Your first chart right at the top is world GDP compared to energy consumption. So for people listening, if you have GDP graphed up the y-axis and you have energy consumption graphed across the x-axis, you get a straight line. One dot lays on top of the next. That's been true for many decades. The punchline being that if you want to have a growing economy, you need to have growing energy use. Let's start there. Is you know, sometimes people say, oh, we're, you know, the energy intensity of the economy's gone way down. We need very little energy now. We will just become more efficient. That's how we get to nirvana. What do you say to that?
Well, what I say to that is that you really have to look at the world situation. I think what tends to happen is a leader or an economist from, you know, some developed country says, oh, we by ourselves can solve our energy problems. We will send all of our manufacturing to China, and we will only in the future do financial services and maybe a little medical care, and we'll do a little bit here and there. But when you get to the world picture, what you find is that the energy use correlates very highly with the growth in GDP. You have to have more energy to get the GDP to grow. And what happens with these alternatives is that they don't scale up well at all. And so what you end up with, if you could use these alternatives, they would produce only just a tiny fraction of what we have right now. So on that basis alone, it becomes very hard to scale. I mean, for instance, if we think about wood, we would deforest the world if we tried to gear our economy to just using wood, even though it's theoretically renewable. I know people argue that the wind and solar are scalable, but yeah, if you have an extra $50 trillion to spend, maybe they are. So what happens is that, as a practical matter, going to so-called renewables would bring us to maybe, you know, 10% or, you know, some small percentage of our current level of energy use, which would bring the whole thing way, way, way down, and it would not allow us to keep our current systems operating. So it would be a very, very big problem.
I totally agree. And this is the important point, which is we have to look at this globally, because you're right. A lot of the, hey, look, we're way more energy independent than we used to be because we've decoupled the GDP output from the energy use. But you're right. We're just offshoring the energy consumption to some other location and then not counting it. So a solar panel gets shipped into this country and we measure the cost of that, but not the energy it took to run that. And then we just say, we got all this great economic benefit from a solar panel without measuring the energy input. So you have to look at this on a global basis. On a global basis, it couldn't be more clear. We have many decades of data in front of us, which is economic expansion and GDP, and oil consumption or energy consumption. Those two things have a correlation coefficient of 0.99. They're awesome. They're really tightly linked. And of course, this should be I'm a biologist by training. That was my PhD is in a natural science. So understanding how energy flows, in this case, chemical energy or electron bond energy or food energy at the organismal level, just understanding energy flows was something I was trained in. And of course, if you want to have a healthy creature, it has to have sufficient energy flows. And you had a piece in a recent article, which I thought was great. I get it because I studied this, but maybe we could make this so other people get it as well. And it's the idea of the economy being a dissipative engine. Like I think the example you used is a hurricane is a dissipative engine. Like it's sitting there, it's taking the latent heat in the ocean and it does crazy, awesome, beautiful things with it and forms a really tight eye wall and has all this beautiful organization, which is funded by energy, and it's dissipating that energy. And eventually when it runs out of that energy, well, what happens next?
Well, if we look at a hurricane, you know, when it goes over land, what happens is that maybe it doesn't fall flat the minute it gets over land, but it doesn't take very many days or very many hours before it loses its force and it comes to an end. Even animals and plants and humans are considered dissipative structures of a somewhat similar form. And we take energy in, and if you stop feeding us, it doesn't take very long before we no longer are alive. So what happens is that without the energy, the economy tends to collapse, contract, and no longer become the same thing it was before.
And that's because it owes its complexity and its order and its structure and all of that to the energy that it's feeding on, right?
Right. Right, because we can build, you know, for instance, the international companies with the energy we have. It allows those international companies to, communicate with each other or to send their executives from country to country, to send the various kinds of the raw materials they need from one place to another. All of this requires energy. If you lose that kind of thing, then the big international organizations start to go, and you have a very different structure than what you had before.
A simpler structure, as it were. There was a great book by Eric Beinhacker called The Origin of Wealth, which I loved. It really changed me a lot, and he's got this great piece in the beginning talking about how many stock keeping units, a SKU in a store would be, one item on the shelf, but if that item is complex enough, like a toaster oven even, it has a number of sub-SKUs in there, like, well, who made the plastic for the handle on this thing, and who made the glass, and who made the heating element, and all of that. And that he noted that the world now has about 10 billion stock keeping units, 10 billion individual things that are measured, tracked, produced, and incorporated into our economy. And could that go to 20 billion? Sure, but here's the point. If and only if we can increase the energy, because that complexity is driven by energy. And we're seeing what's happening in Syria or other places where the energy is in decline, it's contracting. And the social unrest and all of that are symptoms of, though, the withdrawal of the primary life force of any complex system, which is the energy that it gets to consume.
Exactly.
So let's talk about this, because now we're at the heart of what I think is the most unappreciated, most important concept. And I'm struggling myself how to convey this. And I can't wait to get your view on this. Maybe I'm making it too complex. But we went from wood to coal, right? Because coal is better. It's denser.
Right.
And you can do more things with it. And it gets to a hotter temperature. It's just a better fuel. Still, it took 50, 60 years to get to about half of the energy mix being formed by coal. And then we went to oil. Same reason. Denser, better. You can do things with it you can't do with coal. You can fly jets on it. It's amazing, right? Nuclear, decent. That was a nice sort of add-on to that story. But now the world is saying, oh, we're just going to go from things like oil and coal, we're going to go to wind and solar, which are more diffuse. They are a less dense energy source. What are some of the complexities that might arise there?
Well, I think the first thing I would point out is everybody takes the story as far as you got it to the nuclear, the oil to the nuclear. And then I think you have to go back to, and then we went back to adding more coal again because the price mix got too expensive for us. It was just too cost effective. It was no longer cost effective just to use the oil. And we used globalization to effectively raise coal production in China, India, and some other parts of the world, and so that our coal percentage could go back way back up again and help keep the costs down. I think we also brought hydroelectric up. And so we had to work through these directions. We couldn't just go in the way of more and more expensive energy. We had to find a way to balance it out to keep the costs down. Now, when we talk about these more and more diffuse energy sources, we have to get them channeled to the point where we really need them. And I think what happens is a couple of things. One of them is that it's terribly expensive, or at least very expensive, just to put the solar panels or the wind turbines in everywhere and then put in the transmission lines. But what happens is that they, even at that point, are not fully adjusted to what we need. You know, if I look at my energy consumption by month of the year, it's very clear that in the United States, the big energy consumption months are January and February. And so this is the cold, dark time of the year. Now we've got to figure out how in the world are we going to suddenly fix this so that we can get this energy that we really need from the earlier of the year, use wind and solar, and somehow or other channel it to keep us warm when it's cold out. You know, even if you put in batteries, you can't make it last for 6 months. It's just kind of goofy. So, you know, people just have not thought this through. Admittedly, you can put them in and you can say, oh, in the warm parts of the world, we can make it so it's a little easier for people to have air conditioning. Well, that's nice, but that's not what we need to solve our problems.
Well, so let's talk about how we do get to some of this, because certainly, obviously, there are a lot of things we could do if we wanted to become more energy efficient. So let me pick on something easy. We've known for a long time that if you just double the insulation of a house over the life of that house, the energy savings are extraordinary. Building codes still don't require that in the U.S. I'm seeing houses go up right across the street and stick framed with woefully inadequate insulation, given what we know and given the fact that the long-term carrying cost of that house will be vastly lower in a commercial building over its lifespan. 70% of the cost, the life cycle cost of that building, is heating and cooling. And still you'll find, buildings made mostly of glass and other stupid things like that. From an energy standpoint, beautiful architecturally and all that, but from an energy standpoint, we still don't do that. And so that's why I think what you do is so important, what I'm trying to do, which is we need a different story around this, the story that we don't have forever and we don't have infinite amounts of energy. What do you run up against when you try and share that set of ideas with people?
Well, I guess blank, maybe that's the right answer.
Good answer.
People are, they're busy working on CO2 as their big concern. And, by 2050, we'd like to do something or other. And it's not really they don't quite have the understanding that there's a problem now. The low oil prices are a huge problem. And if you look at it, it's really low oil, low coal, low natural gas prices, and low prices on a lot of different kind of commodities. And so we have a real problem right here and now, and it's a low price problem. It's really something that people aren't realizing are a manifestation of what's wrong with our economy.
Now, well, connect that dot, because that's counterintuitive to say that low oil prices are a signal of something that's wrong with our economy. How do you connect those dots?
Well, it's kind of hard to explain, but our economy is a network system, and you have the workers play a double role. And the workers, they receive wages, but then they also use those wages to buy things. And if the workers are getting a smaller and smaller share of the output of the economy in terms of wages, they have a harder and harder time buying things like houses and cars and these big items that really are what our economy grows with. Then it's the fact that there's not enough what we call demand that causes the problem. You know, it's basically the fact that the factory workers and the what I call non-elite workers, the people who have high school educations, aren't getting good enough wages that's causing the problem. And so, and also the fact that young people are spending so many years in college, and then after they get out of college and they're getting relatively low wage jobs when they get out, and they've got this big debt as well, and it all works out that they can't buy new houses. They're not earning enough, and they delay starting their families for the same reason. So all of this cuts back on the demand, and as a result, the price drops lower. I guess the other side of the story is that the price of the cost of extracting oil and all of these other things has tended to go up just because we extract the easiest to extract first, and that's the cheapest to extract. And so we're not able to keep the prices up to the levels that they need to be. And it's the big problem. So we can get a problem. The reason why our supply tends to get cut off is because at least in my view, is likely to be because the prices are too low rather than too high.
Now, I want to get to that because clearly these low prices are way below what's necessary for oil companies to successfully prosecute their investment decisions. So leaving aside that, you know, Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg keep talking about how, you know, shale operators have figured out how to make a lot of money at $40 a barrel. And by the way, people, anybody listening, all you have to do is not read any more of those articles and wander over to the actual investment filings for these companies, and you'll discover they are bleeding at these prices. It's just extraordinary. But on a wider level, we've seen the first investment decisions called FIDs of the major oil companies get reeled way back, perhaps over $1 trillion of investment not made since mid-2014. And so here we are without all those investments being made, such that in 2014 and 15, those were collectively each year was the worst for oil discovery since the 50s, but you put them together back to back, and we haven't had a string that bad in a long time. Less than 3 billion barrels discovered during years when 30 billion barrels were burned. So about a 10% replacement. Gail, getting to that, that has to create a supply problem someday, doesn't it?
You would think so, and it seems like it may not be very far away. I know natural gas supply is down this year in the United States, and coal supply is also down in the United States. So, you know, we got all three of them down in the United States. Worldwide, I think coal supply is down, and it may, well, we're getting more on a plateau with the oil, it may be down as well. So we're going to be start seeing a spike, but when we see a spike, it will fall. What tends to happen when you get a spike in oil prices is it falls through to other prices as well, like food, and the result tends to be that recession, because people find that they need to cut back on discretionary spending, you know, buying things that are optional, because they have to cut back somewhere. And I know I was reading this morning that quite a few restaurant chains are closing because the young people, you know, in the whatever 18 to 35-year-old range, are not buying enough stuff at restaurants anymore. But what you get is a cutting back.
Certainly. So let's talk about the floor-ceiling dynamic of this. We have a floor. You've presented a number of demand destruction-based events that would cause prices to fall. We've been seeing that worldwide. You know, the world economy obviously limping along, not at its normal air quotes, which I think was abnormal, never to be repeated again. Longer story. But, you know, growth rates of 4 and 5% on a real basis and 6 or 7 on a nominal basis, not happening. So on a demand basis, we can see this demand destruction, and that leads to oversupply in the short term. It leads to lower prices. And this, of course, is destroying the companies that are there to produce oil, natural gas, coal. So we've been seeing some fall in their output. We've been seeing retracting investment. But we know that because of your wonderful chart that compares GDP to energy consumption, that it, and consumption and production are the same thing. We don't pull it out and store it for long. So when we look at that, we can just say that falling energy production has got to be associated with falling GDP. That's a bad thing. We have a very unstable financial system that either expands or collapses. It has a very awkward, very delicate in-between moment between those states. But on the same side, if we flip to the other side, we get to the shortfall and prices spike, then that will be too high for the world that's indebted with hundreds of trillions of dollars of outright debt and even 4 or 5 times that amount of unfunded liabilities and other unstated liabilities off balance sheet. So there's a floor which is too low for the energy companies to actually survive and thrive in, and then there's a price that's too high for the economy to operate in. That to me is the floor and the ceiling that I wish people at these energy conferences understood a little better, because when the floor and the ceiling touch, my view is that what is now possible is a fraction of what was possible in a prior time.
Right, and I think we've gotten to a situation where the floor and the ceiling touch. You know, things, it's gotten bad enough so that we don't have, there is no price that works. You know, that the price that the producers need is higher than what the market will bear. And in fact, if we go to a place like Saudi Arabia, you'd say, oh, they can get it out of the ground for $20 a barrel or, you know, some low price. But then when you look at it, you discover that they really need a much higher price if you include in all of the taxes and the need for all of the funding they have so they can keep social order, and so they can import lots of wheat and many other things that the economy needs, and they can build their desalination plants. So they really can't get along on $20 a barrel. They had learned how they could get along on $100 a barrel or $120 a barrel, but they can't get along on $50 a barrel, even in Saudi Arabia. So you end up with a situation where there isn't any kind of a price that really will work when you consider the overall needs of these companies.
Yeah, so that's a great point. I still had the floor and the ceiling in my brain apart a little bit, but you might, I think you're right. So if we can say there's a price, obviously the prices that exist right now are not working for countries and large companies, energy producers, and energy exporting nations. Too low. Obviously, it's already killed Venezuela. That's cooked, and we're just waiting to write the postmortem on that. Saudi Arabia in the process of disintegrating at this point. Russia seeming to do a little better with it all, possibly because they've still priced everything in rubles and the ruble fell too. So they had a little bit of, for financial reasons, a lessening of the pressure on that valve. But at the same time, there's a price which we can clearly see is going to create immense demand destruction on the other side. And the idea that those are almost the same number now, to me, that's got to be, to me, that's one of the most hair-raising, frightening moments, because the only way we're going to build this next future, whatever it is with the energy we've got, period. There's no other way for me to analyze this story. And of course, it's much more complex because of the amount of debt that's been involved, people's belief systems, you know, the complexity of all of that. So, how do we start to listen? You know, doing nothing is not an option, as I mentioned before. We have to do something. So what do we do here?
Well, I have a hard time coming up with something. It's sort of like saying, well, you know, we've looked at this, and with the energy sources that we'll be able to have without the, with just the renewables and such things, it's going to be equivalent to you're living on a 600-calorie-a-day diet. So we'd like you to figure out how you can nicely transition to a 600-calorie-a-day diet. And I think you'll look forward to this new view of life that you are able to take on as you change your diet. You're going, well, I don't think so. This just doesn't work. You know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, well, what do you give up? Do you give up taking care of your electric transmission lines? Do you give up taking care of your oil and gas delivery lines? Do you give up taking care of your roads? You know, it's all of this infrastructure stuff by itself would take the equivalent of your 600-calorie diet. And so you suddenly discover that all of the pieces that you depended on are the parts that so desperately need energy. And so it's very, very hard to cut back, or at least the way I look at it is.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. And so it's a complex relationship. So to perhaps tease this apart a little more, illustrate it. In a recent post, you said, quote, "The popular idea that we extract 50% of a resource before peak and 50% after peak will be found not to be true. Much of the second 50% will stay in the ground," unquote. There's a lot of really deep thinking embedded in that deceptively simple quote. Help us unpack that, would you?
Yes, I think an awful lot of people listened to, or, you know, looked at the work of Hubbard and said, well, what Hubbard has said is the absolutely gospel true story for all times and all places in all conditions. And what we can expect is this nice Hubbard-shaped curve, so to speak, that goes up and it goes down sort of slowly. And so this is, you know, what we should expect going forward. And so oil supply will kind of continue like it has before. It will decline rather slowly going forward. Well, that's, you know, that's true if you're talking about a particular well and there are new wells taking its place, and the price of the oil in the new well is roughly the same as in the old well, and everything is going along fine. Everybody has a good wage level. You know, everybody can feed themselves. You can build new oil wells, and everything is working out fine. But what happens as you get past the 50% mark is that you no longer have enough oil coming out so that the economy can keep growing. It starts going down. And what happens then is that the economy doesn't function the same way. And, you know, you start getting the prices to spike as you try to get higher cost oil out. And this is what we saw like in the 2007-2008 period. And, you know, when that happens, then the prices spike, you get recession, and it comes back down. People, these higher prices don't come back through to wages, and then you get the very low price problem that we have right now. So it doesn't work right. You can't keep getting the oil out, essentially because the wages of the people don't stay up high enough in order to afford the output of the economy.
Now, you know, as I travel the world, Gail, and I go to all these different countries, every capital city is the same. They're all the same. It doesn't really matter which nation I'm in or which continent I'm on. They're all the same, and they're all jammed with cars. And I always make a point of looking at the cars to find out how many are internal combustion engines and how many are electric. And guess what? It's very hard to find electric cars. You see the very rare Tesla in some of the key metropolitan areas, and that's it. And so, you know, I have this other idea, which is that the world absolutely has to have oil in order to even keep functioning at all. Don't you think that governments would nationalize and overspend, even if it doesn't make sense from a energy or a dollar standpoint, to get those last drops of oil out?
Well, I mean, you start with Saudi Arabia. It's already nationalized its oil company. Okay, and at this price, the price is way too low. Now, where would Saudi Arabia get the money from to subsidize its oil industry? It gets all of its money from the oil industry. It can't subsidize it. And we've got Russia out there, and where would it subsidize its oil industry from? I mean, that's where it gets its taxes from. As you look around the world, that's the situation. Oil is a big source of taxes. But you're talking about, say, the United States, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how many people are going to vote for a politician who says, well, we've decided that our oil industry needs $120 a barrel oil, and the price is only about $50. So, you know, we would like to increase the price by that amount. We'd like to subsidize our oil companies to that effect. And, you know, how many voters are going to vote for that, you know, because that's going to come through to higher costs at the pump. And it's going to come through, well, I guess, I'm not quite sure where they're going to get the subsidy from.
Well, maybe otherwise, they'll just print it up.
We'll just print it up, yeah, right. I think that we're going to end up with some situations where you get then the falling dollar relative to the other currencies. And so then if you're getting the falling dollar, then you get the oil price to go back up again to some extent. But and this all of this gets to be a big mess because I'm not sure that I don't think the politicians would do it in the first place, but it would printing the dollars would also affect the relativity. So all of it gets to be complicated.
Yeah, big moving pieces. I mean, I only slightly joked about the printing it up because I think we would try that because, you know, currently
yeah,
we've
right.
got another delusion out there, which is, look, apparently we can print tons and nothing bad happens. You know, but again, that's just storing storing potential energy for a future date. You know, we'll see how that turns out. But ultimately, the dollar price doesn't matter. That's the hard part I find in this conversation is it doesn't matter. Is it a penny a barrel? Is it $1 million a barrel? What really matters is the net energy that's available to flow through the system, what constructs we put around it and what we price money at and what we call that is interesting, necessary, complexity to understand, but ultimately irrelevant. If we have falling net energy per capita, we're going to discover that it's harder and harder for the average person to get by, and that creates political pressures, social pressures, all kinds of other things. That really, you know, when people say, oh, I remember in the 70s, one person could earn the wage necessary to support a house, even at minimum wage. Like, yep. And that's kind of where we hit our net energy per capita coming out of our own oil fields. And it's been kind of downhill ever since. So that's an explanatory and maybe even a predictive sort of an analysis that you could put on there that overlays quite nicely. But very few people still have that energy awareness of the role that it really actually plays, and everything is a little bit of a derivative from that, even though it's an interacting derivative. So, you know, with that, we are out of time, but I just wanted to thank you so much for your time today, and especially, Gail, for your work and educating people about something most don't really still want to be educated about, but boy, still as necessary as ever. And I will direct people back to your website, ourfiniteworld.com. Is there any other way people can track you or keep in touch with you or maybe go see you at a conference?
Well, I guess there's a Twitter, and it's Gale the Actuary, all one word, G-A-I-L-T-H-E, Actuary. I don't have any upcoming conferences that are, well, the one I know of that's upcoming is in Europe, and I don't think it's something that I would advertise right now. Mm-hmm. So I think Our Finite World is probably the best place.
Well, great. And hopefully you would post there when you do have an upcoming conference. So I would invite people to read the site, read the blog, see you if they can. And we'll have you back on again at some point, because I know this conversation is just starting for the world.
Okay.
Well, thank you again.
Thanks for calling. Yes. Appreciate it. Bye.
My pleasure.